1:1:1, the first one, I'm going to read this one first, comes from our very well-known Noah. So those who are listening in podcast, get ready. It's another very interesting question. And I will give a fairly elaborate answer. Okay? How have meditation researchers been able to isolate the EG correlates for experiences such as staying on the objects, various levels of excitation, laxity, or vividness? The answer is no. So there are short answers. In fact, why don't I get the short answer first? Okay? So the answer is no, not yet. Might they? Why not? But so far, really good, high-caliber scientific research in psychology and neuroscience on meditation, really top drawer. It's about 10 years old. Before then, there were other studies, but really, they were not of very high caliber. They were generally not very well-funded. It was pretty fringe. And now, when we have people like, people in John Cohen's lab at Princeton, and people at Harvard, and Wisconsin, and University of California, well, now it's gone absolutely mainstream. And so you won't lose your reputation, and you won't sabotage your own career in cognitive science if you want to go into this area. So it can happen, hasn't happened yet, just because it's such a new field. Might it be possible for a meditator to more swiftly navigate at least some of the earlier stages of shamatha, if not all the way up to sense implosion, by augmenting his or her introspection with some kind of meditative neurofeedback training? The answer is possibly. Okay? So those are the short answers, no and possibly. That's the root text. Here comes the commentary. Okay, the first one I find very intriguing, and that is, could this happen? And that is my dream here, frankly. My dream, and I'm looking over at the right over in that corner where the contemplative observatory will hopefully be built, assuming we can get these long-term visas. My dream there is that we'll have our laboratory here, and we'll have everything that's needed except for MRI, and we've already been in consultation with people, doctors at the Bangkok Hospital, and they have given us permission to use their brand new MRI. So that's the big expensive machine. I think they cost $2 to $3 million, don't they, Enrique? Something like that. I think about $3 million for a good one. But besides that, the equipment is not that expensive. EEG is quite cheap. And for cognitive psychology, you need some computers and a video camera. You don't need that much. And you might want to do some physiological markers of, using saliva and so forth. But my dream has been, and I don't think it's unfeasible, is to get, a good number of people. I mean, eventually we'll start with perhaps 20, if we can do this here in Thailand with the visa business, put up facilities for 20 people. Just boom, put up 20. And right now our notion is, this is Klaus and I in a dialogue we had, we thought tentatively, now this could change, again, everything hinges on the visa, but if we can solve that, then putting up 5 four-room units, each will have its own private, just what you have right now, your own shower, toilet, sink, and be about the same size, and with air conditioning. We discussed that. We're not going to try to make it too austere or ascetic. It's going to be comfortable. Okay? And the room's about the size of what you have now, which is not ascetic. And you'll have your own you'll have your table, a chair, your bed, and so forth. You only need one bed, so we don't need to spend the extra money for two beds. There we cut something. And so, get up 20 and fill them. And then once those are filled, if things are going well, then build another 20. So, but if we had 20 to 40 people practicing full-time, really going full throttle on practicing shamatha, and we have our lab up, we have the laboratory up, and we have somebody here who's resident, and I know a person I think would love to do this, and is very, very capable, then what would be marvelous to see, and this could take, let's say, be generous, 5 years, of having 20 to 40 people, nice, fairly large number, and have them meditating regularly and with no outside hassles, just wonderful, conducive environment, they know how to practice, and they're practicing, and then have them keep their first-person journals of how is it going, where do they sense from month to month, really, I think not week to week, you all know that, but month to month, where would you place yourself in terms of the 9 stages? What is your normal meditation session? And then just clock it, but keep a daily journal, what seems relevant, and then maybe every month, do some absolutely non-invasive measurements from the EEG, and some very, very basic behavioral studies. I mean, this just entails using a computer screen and some very simple measurements we used in the shamatha project. And then, once a month, I'm not sure it might be too expensive, maybe it would have to be a little bit less, maybe once every 3 months, put people in a minivan, very low impact, drive over to the Bangkok Hospital, and get structural and functional MRI. So you know if parts of the structural MRI, what parts of the brain are actually growing, because they do, they do. And overall the functioning of the brain, what parts are being activated. So I have people go into the magnet, into the MRI, and practice shamatha after they've been doing it for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. And so having from the psychological side, which is behavioral, and also the first person account, and then from the pure neurophysiological side, the EEG and the MRI. So now we have a three-dimensional, first person, psychological, neuroscience, a three-dimensional map. And then run the experiment for 1, 2 years, however long it takes, until people are achieving shamatha. It's almost like popcorn. You just keep those little kernels in there until they pop, you know? And then I say this only half in jest, like a woman who's 9 months pregnant and she thinks any day. And then she says, my water broke, and then they rush her off to hospital, right? My water broke, oh, zipper off. Well, when a person gets to, you know, stage nine, and they're thinking, any day, you know? Then as soon as it starts to happen, then put him in an ambulance and rush him off to the hospital and put him into the MRI. What's happening when they have this pressure on top of the head and these incredible things happening in the body? It must be major. You know, really must be very major, and you should be able to pick up something quite significant from EEG and MRI. And nobody's ever achieved shamatha in an MRI tube before. And so if we had not one, that could be an anomaly, but we have 10, 15, 20 people over the course of 5 years, let's say. I don't think this is wildly unrealistic. Where we've got this map, and then we're finding, now we're doing good science. Because if it's one person, you can say, well, that's your brain. How do we know whether anybody else is like this? But if you have 20 people who are clearly progressing along the 9 stages, then you tease out, we get a mathematician like Enrique, mathematician, tease out what are the regularities. There will undoubtedly be just individual characteristics. People's brains are different, age, gender, and so forth and so on. But can we tease out of this what are the regularities? And then out of that, and then regularities also from their first person accounts. And then put that together, when we have 20 people who have achieved shamatha, and put that together, and then teasing out, here are the regularities from the first person. This is phenomenology, this is direct observation, this is not a teaching about shamatha, this is what happens. And what happens for the behavioral measurements? What happens for EEG, what happens for MRI? Now, once you have that, then you could ask, so that would be the answer to that question. And it would take, I think, 5 years could be a reasonable timeline, and not massively expensive. The most expensive could be the MRI. They're expensive to lease, okay? Until then, neurofeedback, probably pretty dodgy, because what exactly are you feeding back? You know, you wouldn't know. A number of my friends are actually working in the neurofeedback kind of area. And I've spoken with scientist friends of mine, and they tell me, well, that's a big question mark. In terms of hardcore science, this is an unproven field, neurofeedback. It doesn't mean that it's bogus, that it's just snake oil or, you know, just placebo, but they don't know. And so if there had been any really rigorous studies of neurofeedback, then that would either discredit it or put it on more of a scientific standing. Right now, I think it's unknown. But now let's branch out from that. So in principle, if you did know the EEG signatures, could you then possibly link a person up with a cap, and they're very easy to put on, and they're getting easier and easier, and then have them meditate, and then when they, you know, when their the EEG signature or, you know, the pattern shows that they're getting up maybe the next stage, then it gives them some positive feedback, whereas when they're slipping back, a negative feedback, and so they have basically an electric augmenter of introspection. Okay? That could be it. So could that help? Maybe. Maybe so. Maybe, who knows, maybe it could help all the way. Now let's imagine, though, that we have 20 or 40 people who are developing exceptional attention skills. I mean, really, more than anything that researchers at Harvard have noticed, that people can focus their attention for 7 seconds and so forth and so on. We're just blowing that all off the map. We're just rewriting the book. Because students at Harvard and Wisconsin and UC Berkeley and UC Davis and so forth are not spending 8 hours a day for months and months on end. They're not doing that. They're coming into the lab fresh from their classes. So what do you expect? 7 seconds is really good, you know? And so let's imagine that we're just rewriting the textbooks about the plasticity of attention Because scientists thus far, apart from the UC Davis study, they're not doing these longitudinal studies, right, to test the, you know, effects on attention. Well, let's imagine not for 3 months, not for 8 weeks, but we have people going for 1, 2, 5 years, whatever. And so after a year or so, let's imagine we have a number of people who have achieved stage 5, 6, maybe even stage 7, maybe further, who knows. But that means they can sit there and their minds are focused for 2 or 3 hours at a stretch. And they're doing this multiple times a day, maybe 10, 11, 12 hours a day. And it's not just one, like one anomaly, some person who landed from a UFO, but, you know, one of us. Then, if the word, so the word gets out, so we publish, you know, this is happening. There are a number of institutions out there that would be very keen on, you know, high level attention skills. So the first thing that comes to mind is military. So much money, just unlimited resources. That you can just count on. If the military is involved, big bucks. But there could be other disciplines as well. Some less, you know, oriented towards war. And I think you can come up with your own list. But when you tell them, well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that people, ordinary people with training, can develop their attention skills to exceptional levels, more than you ever even imagined, more than William James ever dreamed, although he'd be so happy. That's the good news. The bad news, you have to do it 8 hours a day for a year. And people who are outside of Dharma would say, well, that's really bad news. That's because we're not going to do it. We're busy. And we need to quick this up. So what was that business about neurofeedback? How about we check out the brain chemistry of people along these different stages? And then we just inject the suckers. You know, we just find some healthy young recruit and say, give us your head. And just give them the drug, you know, that seems to jack up, to alter the brain chemistry. So suddenly, you know, I am really concentrated, you know. So let's find a drug. Or if we can, why don't, there's a whole business going. I won't mention details here, of a person who feels he's found certain frequencies of the EG that correspond to certain meditative states. And so frequencies are really easy to create artificially, so he does. And then he just beams those frequencies into the head. He has people put on earphones and just beams it inwards with the idea that it's going to kind of resonate and you'll start going along with the same frequency that's being beamed into your head. And suddenly, oh. And, you know, so this person thinks there's a scientific basis for it, never been scientifically validated. How about just some brain surgery? Maybe we just cut out those parts that are distracting you. Just get in there and give it the knife. Or we can just find some drug, just a drug that's just going to, samadhi drug, you know, just... So we already have samadhi drugs for people who have attention deficit disorder. It's called Ritalin. And there are some drugs out there on the market to help attention, help enhance attention and memory. Whether they work, I have no idea, but I know there are some out on the market. And then there are some games out there that are feedback games to help develop attention skills. They're more in the mode of games for children and so forth. And so, and I'll just go here very briefly. But what if it's true, as the Hindus and the Taoists, and even to some extent the Christians, and certainly the Buddhists have been saying for centuries, is that if you develop really high states of samadhi, then you can develop remote viewing, and you can read the minds of others, and you may be able to walk through walls and do other very interesting kinds of things. Well, then we know the military will be interested, and they'll pay pretty much anything, if that can be validated. See, the studies that have been done thus far, and the ones I know best, are by Russell Targ, and I know him personally, and he ran, again, about 20 years of research at the Stanford Research Institute with millions of dollars of funding from the CIA and the Defense Department. And what he told me was that with all that money poured into it, and he's a physicist, he's a very responsible scientist, he came away from these something like 20 years, maybe not quite that long, but these years and years of training people and doing research on it, of precognition and remote viewing, all right? He came away from this saying, to my mind, this is no longer a matter of belief. This is just the empirical facts are overwhelming that remote viewing does happen. It is trainable, and so does precognition. And it's not a matter of belief I see the evidence and it's incontrovertible. That's his view. Obviously, not everybody agrees with him. But the military was able to, you know, was willing to support this for years. And the military turned it down just because it wasn't accurate enough. It was something, if my memory serves, and I'm not sure it does, but I think it was something like 60% accuracy. And the military, from what Russell Targ told me, was the military just, you know, said, we can't base military strategy on people doing remote viewing or what have you with a 60% accuracy. So we should rely on the CIA, for example, that has, you know, much, much better, for example, in noting with certainty, slam dunk, the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, that was worth fighting a war over. Or was it? My memory's a little bit foggy on that one, but I know it was a slam dunk. That one I remember. Absolutely slam dunk. Because after all, Colin Powell said it to the whole UN. It must be true. He's a man of integrity. And so, but that's with very little training. Very little training. And interestingly enough, if you read his books, you can get maybe two or three, four books out there on Amazon.com you can get. But what was crucial to really unveil this capacity, because he feels, of course, that it's innate. It's not something you get from the techniques or from outside. Everybody has an innate capacity for example, remote viewing. So the question is, how can you unveil that capacity? And I remember it was essentially, even though he really knew very little about Buddhism at this time, because this was a good 25 years ago or so, it was learning how to still the mind, to remain a real sense of clarity, to remain focused, and to get the conceptual mind to die down so that you don't conflate what you're actually viewing with mental awareness as opposed to what you're projecting. And I looked at every single point that he said, this is what you need to do, and I said, well, that's shamatha. I mean, it's just nothing more, nothing less than shamatha. But of course, he had no idea about shamatha training of 9 stages and spending 8 hours a day. He never did it. Nobody he trained did it. So if it turned out to be the case, as Buddhists, for example, have been saying for 2,500 years, that if you achieve shamatha and then work with that ability, you can develop some very interesting and potentially very beneficial extrasensory powers. Atisha, again, remember Atisha. People without extrasensory perception cannot really work for the good of sentient beings. And extrasensory perception comes through practicing shamatha, achieving shamatha. There it is. I mean, it's a direct link by one of the greatest contemplatives and scholars of Mahayana Indian Buddhism. So, if that should be demonstrated, that even subject A, subject B, keeping it all anonymous, you know, were able to demonstrate this, then there's going to be a mad rush. There's going to be a mad rush, not just for the United States. It's going to be major institutions around the world. I mean, man, the potentials here are fantastic. And so then we'll see a major concerted effort to just detour around little things like ethics and the cultivation of mental balance, the cultivation of the four immeasurables. The sheer lust for power will be absolutely like a herd of buffalo going full speed ahead, all 100,000 of them. And so there are, what gives me a lot of confidence in teaching shamatha is going right back to the teachings of the Buddha himself, that if, like the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, cousin, not nephew, cousin, wasn't it? Yeah, cousin. If, like Devadatta, you actually achieve shamatha, and beyond shamatha, access to the first jhana, you achieve the first, the second, the third, fourth. I think he achieved all four of them and developed a pretty powerful array of siddhis or paranormal abilities. It's clear there. It tells in the suttas what he could do. And then his mind really did turn really malevolent. First jealousy, and then malice. And then he lost it all. So when he tried to kill the Buddha, he didn't try to kill the Buddha using psychic powers. He tried to kill the Buddha with an elephant. You know, you're back to just, you know, murder. I mean, it's not very imaginative. And so, but that's the safeguard. And that is, shamatha is a path of power. There's no question about it. You're gaining power over your own mind. You're gaining mastery of your own mind. You're developing a laser out of a flashlight of your own attention. And so there's power in it, no question. But it's power that comes with the five jhana factors and the overcoming of the five hindrances, overcoming malice. That means you can't have shamatha and have malice at the same time. One has to go, right? Sensual craving, one has to go. And that sensual craving for the bounties of the desire realm, which is what governments are all about, right? And let alone the others, you know, the laxity, the dullness, the excitation, the anxiety, the uncertainty, all of those are gone. And moreover, this training of attention skills, which is what shamatha is about, really is embedded in a larger framework of the higher training of samadhi. We have shila. Well, it doesn't happen without shila. You recall that one of the absolutely indispensable prerequisites for achieving shamatha internally, pure ethics. Pure ethics. If it's not there, you just missed one of the, then you won't get it. You just won't get it, right? So that's built in already, right? And then we have things like having few desires and contentment. And so we have the ethical foundation. There it is. And then when we go to the higher training of samadhi, dingin zingi lapa, the higher training of samadhi, of course, that's not just shamatha. That's the cultivation of the four immeasurables and awareness of impermanence and so forth and so on. So we see that this extraordinary enhancement and development of attention skills are taking place in a broader framework of developing exceptional, extraordinary mental balance and mental health, right? And so I speak of four. In a paper that I wrote that was co-authored, that was published in the American Psychologist, I speak of cognitive balance. This is developing authentic, really authentic, wholesome aspirations, desires, intentions. So that's one crucial one. And then there's attentional balance itself. There's cognitive balance. We're really being present with what is and not conflating it with what we project and not just going, how do you say, going oblivious of what's actually happening. And then emotional balance. Well, we can all see the relevance of the four immeasurables for that. But to developing the equanimity, but the open heart, the caring heart, that would be integral to the emotional balance. Well, shamatha takes place within that context. You don't just throw out the other three and say, just, you know, it's not like ice cream. I don't want those flavors. I'll just take that one flavor. Doesn't work that way, right? And so it's embedded in there. And so there are all these safeguards that we see the cultivation of shamatha is taking place in an overall maturation. We take the verb wise. I would like the verb enwisening. You know, there's a process of becoming wise in all of this. Wise in our aspirations and our ideals and our values. Becoming wise. Developing attention skills. Developing a clarity, a wisdom in terms of how we attend to reality with cognitive balance. And then emotional intelligence. To use Dan Goleman's term, emotional intelligence, emotional wisdom. That we're wise in how we emotionally respond to a wide variety of circumstances. So shamatha is taking place within this wonderful nest of overall psychological and spiritual maturation, all of this embedded in the very rich soil of ethics. So let alone all the stuff of the Pentagon and CIA and everybody wanting to, you know, short-circuit this and just develop, you know, robo-cops and robo-warriors and so forth and so on. Here's the question that I think on a deeper level, a more philosophical level, a more existential level, that might at least give us pause about going in this direction at all. And that is, if even at the beginning we use a technique, maybe Ritalin would be really helpful for the first stage or two. I don't know, I've never taken it. Might. So maybe a little bit of drug, or I know that there's a natural substance and also a pharmaceutical drug that have been found helpful for enhancing or facilitating lucid dreaming. One's an herb. That doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. It just means it's organic. And the other one is a drug that's used to treat Alzheimer's. And lo and behold, if you take the drug, even if you don't, whether or not you're coming, you know, you have Alzheimer's, it tends to really enhance the clarity and frequency of dreams. So your dream life becomes much more vivid. And this plant does as well. So I know somebody who teaches lucid dreaming and then gives out these drugs during the, quietly, and kind of quietly, because I think the one is definitely a, not an over-the-counter. It's a prescription drug. But wants to kickstart. Wasn't that the word? Wants to kickstart to get people dreaming lucidly quickly. And then, this is what it's like. They get enthused. Oh, I can do this. I can do this. So whether it's drugs for lucid dreaming, whether it's drugs or some other type of technological enhancement, even moving from stage one to stage two, why are we doing this? To make it go faster. It's that simple. Make it go faster. I don't want to hang out on stage one. It's not very satisfying. I don't like sucking, and I suck. So get me out of here. Just get me out of here. I want to move out. This is a bad neighborhood. Stage one is a really bad neighborhood. At least stage two, it's okay. It's still low rent district, but, you know, it's better than living in a cardboard box, right? And then stage three, well, definitely getting middle class here. Stage four, you've now made it, you know, and there we are. Why even think about these questions at all is to speed things up, to progress more quickly. The question that I would raise, and won't try to answer it, but I will raise it because I think it's significant, is if we have some technological enhancement, whether chemicals or electricity or neurofeedback, whatever it may be, if that's jumping us ahead, stage 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, whatever, that means it didn't come entirely from within, it came with some intrusion from outside. That means that we are using a crutch. That we were not using our limbs, we're using a crutch. Now we have like a wooden crutch. But if you start walking around relying heavily on a crutch, maybe on the right side, and you're actually healthy, but you decide, this is a really great crutch. I really like this crutch. And you start walking a lot with a crutch. What's going to happen to the muscles in your right leg? They're going to atrophy, right? If you're a little kid and somebody gives you a super crutch, it helps you walk much faster than just without a crutch. I mean, it's a supercharged crutch. Then the little kid would grow up with a left leg that's doing really well and a right leg that's just kind of like a tail. And drags along because you got a great crutch, you know? And so if we're letting some technology do the work, what isn't being developed? What's being overridden that would have done the work otherwise? That is, if we're finding, oh gosh, my mind is still so scattered, is that because our priorities, our ideals, our aspirations are not really yet in line very much with genuine happiness? It's more just hedonic stuff. So give me a crutch. Is it that? Is it that we're ethically not really up to standard in one way or another? But not really what it needs to be, but give me a crutch. And so that even though, so I don't need to improve my ethical level, but I got this crutch from outside, so I can still have mediocre ethics, but it will be overlooked because I've got the crutch. So when this shamatha's practice, as it has been for the first 2,500 years, when things are going slowly, then you check out, you go back to the roots and say, why? Is it ethics? What kind of desires? Is it anger? Is it craving? Is it sensual craving? Is it fear? What am I afraid of? And you ask those questions, hopefully have a good teacher, and then you work through fear. If it's sensual craving, you work through that. If it's ethics, you improve the ethics. But you work it so the foundation really is sufficient. Give you an example that troubled me a bit that I saw on the online news. It was a man who was 40 years old. This was on MSNBC. That was shown on NBC Evening News, should you want to track it, just a couple of days ago. But it was of an American man, 40 years old, and he suddenly found himself out of work. And he fell into a deep depression, virtually suicidal, just feeling, what do I have to live for? He didn't see any real good prospects for getting a job again. And so he just fell into a really debilitating depression. And it was because he lost his job. I mean, he wasn't depressed, he lost his job, then he's depressed, and really deeply depressed. And so he went to a psychiatrist, and what do you imagine the psychiatrist did? He gave him a drug. It's the anti-lose your job drug. Gave him a drug. I can imagine all kinds of responses to a person who's grappling with issues of low self-worth and maybe a bit of hopelessness and fixation entirely on hedonic pleasure and the mind becoming somewhat rigid. Maybe the elasticity, the imagination has gotten a bit cramped down because the mind gets so depressed. We don't see alternatives. We don't see about, could I go back to school? Might I move to another state? When we get depressed, we can become stupid. That is, we don't have full access to our intelligence. I know, I've been depressed, not clinically, but I'm not as smart as I, you know, when the mind becomes overwhelmed by any emotion, especially depression, it's not as bright. There we are. So he was simply given a drug. There was no reference to any talk therapy. He was given the drug, and they mentioned this person in the context of a rather sobering fact, and that is, And they just showed an array of these antidepressant drugs. Now, according to a study that was done just within the last couple of years, it was shown that this whole array of antidepressant drugs, and I quote almost verbatim Sharon Begley, who's the science writer for Newsweek, and she's one of maybe the best that I know in that field, but she did a whole very well-researched article in Newsweek a couple of years back and showed that according to these latest large-scale studies, that the whole array of drugs is either not at all better or negligibly better than the placebo, which means nothing at all, placebo, for people with mild to moderate depression. And only in cases of very acute, very intense depression do they show clearly they are better than simply giving people a sugar tablet, a salt tablet, with a lot of authority, and this will certainly make, you know, the whole thing that goes around making the so-called placebo effective. So we already knew that. I mean, that's in the public domain. This has really come out in the public just in the last couple of years. What I'd learned in this report a couple of nights ago was that for the same array of drugs, in 14% of the cases, it makes people more suicidal than if they hadn't taken the drug. 14% become more suicidal. And then a study was just done of the electrical activity of the brain, and it showed that for that percentage, it seemed to be a strong correlation. For these people who become more suicidal after taking the antidepressant drug, that their brain activity goes down by 600%. So, looking at all of this, why I went off on that tangent is that when taking drugs, when we're looking for these shortcuts, all kinds of unexpected things can come up. To suddenly discover, after we have how many dozens of these drugs on the market, that 14% of the time they make people suicidal and they drop the activity of the brain by 600%. Whoops! I mean, that's a pretty enormous whoops. Oh, and by the way, they probably don't work anyway. And so the doctors are in a conundrum here. When you're giving a person a drug that suddenly turns out to be no better than the placebo, but the person's getting benefit, the doctors face a real moral dilemma here. So they know the drug they're giving them for just moderate depression. The studies are clear. It's either no benefit or negligible benefit, and it's costing an arm and a leg. Somebody's paying for it. That's why our medical expenses are enormously high in the States. So do you still keep on having, you know, the insurance company paying and paying and paying, or the person paying out of pocket for something that's basically no better than a sugar tablet, but the person believing it works gets better? Or do you just fess up and say, you know, the pills I've been prescribing for you with all of my education and all of that, they were worthless. I kind of embarrassed to say, but they were worthless. You may as well stop taking, but would you like this sugar tablet? It's a moral dilemma. So that's my fundamental concern. Not just that that some evil country with an evil military is going to get their hands on it and use it and so forth, but just if we are relying on the crutch, then what aren't we using that would have got us there also, but maybe more in a balanced and integrated fashion? So that's that. So it's more of a question. So I'm not ideologically against it, any more than I'm ideologically against people taking Ritalin if they're suffering from ADHD. It's wonderful that they can have that crutch, right? On the other hand, I heard some time ago about a person who was diagnosed at very early age, childhood, with Ritalin, and now is well into adulthood, and has been taking that drug the whole life. The whole life. And I have no idea whether it's related to Ritalin, but other very major psychological problems requiring massive drugs, which has made this person so he can't even work anymore. And his doctors won't give him therapy, and they won't let him get off the drugs. If this were a different situation, I'd say his doctors are drug peddlers, and they've got him hooked, and they will not let him off. And he can't work, so he's on disability. And that's a sad situation. It's a sad situation. So if a person takes Ritalin at the age of 4 and winds up taking it for the next 50 years, I think that person should get frequent flyer miles. I mean, I know I fly on a certain airline a lot, and when I fly 100,000 miles, they give me a lot of perks. I get go to right in with the business class people, and I get the better seats, and I get a lot of free upgrades and so forth, because I fly with one company and one alliance pretty much all the time. And so I'm a really good customer for them. They really like me. I flew 200,000 miles with the same little alliance last year, and I got whole bunch of free upgrades, and would you like this, and you like that, and so forth. I think the drug companies, when they get somebody hooked on their drugs for 20, 30, 40 years, they should just give them free tickets to Tahiti. Because we've made millions off of you. At least tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands. And gee, thanks, you know? You're our best Ritalin customer. Have a trip to Hawaii. And don't let it get you distracted.